big rocks and all that sort of thing.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, will you welcome to the stage Johnny James Hutton and Mr. Mick Wall?
Readers. Let me hear you say, in the actuality.
In the actuality!
I think they know the podcast. And why are we here? We're here to make Saudi money. Say Saudi money. We're going to make it rain. All right, stop that.
Get on with it, for Christ's sake.
Sorry, yes. Exactly. Oh, wow. Right.
Perfect.
Right.
Don't milk it.
Yeah,
is Ross Half in here?
I'm not one to milk it. Let's make that clear. Now it's a great show tonight. If you were here, anybody was here last time?
Oh, bloody hell!
Gluttons for they're your friend. John's fans are here. I see. I hope that bloody Rush guy isn't here, John.
Oh no, I hope he is. Oh, he is.
Oh,
fantastic!
Oh no,
he hasn't shut up about that since. Anyway.
Oh, well, you're a hero, aren't you? Yeah, we'll get to that. Thank you. Much appreciated contribution from the back. Now, readers, we thought tonight we would start out with some rock news. Oh, yeah. And this is the stuff that's hot off the press. So hot, I'm going to have to read it. Hang on. Because in the hours and hours of preparation for this show, it's not like I just dash it off at the last minute in the cab. You know, that's not the way we go, is it, John?
No, Rick.
No. So we're going to start with some... here we go. Who has heard the most recent pod about the AC/DC clock? Yeah. What's your feelings? Any good... Wasted. Is that Rush again? But AC/DC, I mean, who's left? There's Angus.
Are we doing this again?
We're live, John. We haven't done it live before. There's Angus, there's Jono, and there's a bloody big clock. Did you get excited by the clock?
No. I'm too young to have seen them in their prime anyway.
Well, that's most of us, isn't it? Except me, I saw them in their prime. All right, well, that went down well, so...
What was that it? That was the news?
I was waiting... No, that was one item.
I thought you were going to add something to it.
That was one item. Here's another item.
This is terrible.
Well, you jump in then.
I apologise for this.
Jump in.
I didn't know you were just going to rehash something we did already. Yeah.
John, please, give us a fresh take.
I've got nothing to say about AC/DC at all.
Bon Jovi documentary on Disney. Anybody seen that? No one has. I haven't. I mentioned it to John. He wouldn't even discuss it, would you?
No, I've got zero. Is it? I'd be interested if it was a biopic, like the one they did of The Dirt. That was good.
Bon Jovi?
Yeah. They had actors. The guy who was Ozzy was amazing. They'd get a crowbar Ozzy into that. That would be great.
Okay. All right, so we're off to a flying start. I'm going to forget the news, because I don't think that's going very well.
Thank God. I said
as you know,
do it.
Our special guest this evening is the one and only Stephen Wilson.
Yes.
Let's hear it for Stephen. Now, Stephen is known, not to his friends, but to us behind his back, as the Lord of the studio, as the whiz.
Well, he is. When you think of Stephen Wilson...
Yeah, go on, John.
You think of...
When you think
sound,
of...
you know, soundscape, you think, well, like, you know, what does he do all day?
What does he do all day?
I mean, I've got his book here. It's a collaboration between Stephen and Mick.
Yeah.
And there is a lot of studio stuff in it, I have to say.
Yeah. Well, there would be, though, wouldn't there?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So when you think of Stephen, you think of the studio. So I was just having a chat with him just now. We're talking about what we might talk about. And I said, well, does the concept of the studio exist anymore? Because everyone does it at home, don't they? Back in the day, the time you're going to talk about, the era we want to talk about, a record company would give you $1.5 million or whatever it was and say, right, go away for 12 months. Go to...
12 weeks.
No. How long did these albums take? Seriously, they take years sometimes. Def Leppard, those kind of people.
Six months.
Go to a residential studio... with a load of money, with an all-star producer, and will come back when you're finished. I think that world is gone.
Well, it's gone because people don't buy records anymore.
Exactly.
Record companies could do that because the record would make millions, so they're quite happy to budget. But these days, literally no one, compared to the millions. I mean, Iron Maiden are the only band left that I know of personally that still do it the old way. You know, they'll find a big expensive studio in Paris or the Bahamas and they'll book it out for 3 or 4 months. Steve Harris always goes to an Airbnb, always. Nico McBrain always goes for the 5-star penthouse suite in the hotel. I want my suite! That's Nico, by the way. And they bring in Kevin Shirley for about 12 weeks. And
yeah, that's Kevin Shirley's your mate, isn't he?
He's my mate.
You went to Malibu with Kevin Shirley, didn't you? To his little mate. He was so pleased with himself. He was all puffed up. Oh, I've been to Malibu with Kevin Shirley.
You know I wouldn't be like that.
He was exactly like that.
Just because
Kev... He was all giddy. He's mixing an album. It's amazing. Yeah.
What the fuck is he talking about? Now, listen, I may have spent some time in the boo, with Kevin, or Kev, as he's known to his dear friends like me.
The caveman.
The caveman, yes.
You remember that.
But we thought to sort of set the scene a bit before Stephen comes out, who really is... Stephen's probably been in more studios than any artist we've ever thought of.
I mean, we'll find out. I presume he lives in one or has one... in very close proximity to where he lives, I would imagine.
Well, we'll find out, John.
Exactly,
there's one of your questions for him right
don't
away.
I want to blow them early.
It's in his garage.
In his garage? What did he say?
Yeah, it's in his garage.
Is there more to that?
Where does he put his car then? We can find this stuff out. Yeah, he's got a shed. He might have two sheds.
Well, two sheds. He's known as Stephen Two Sheds Wilson, isn't he? In fact, I can exclusively reveal his next album. Working title is Two Sheds.
One of the people that he is famous for remixing, Jethro Tull, once went to Ian Anderson's house.
You did?
Yeah, and it was so big, it had two addresses. Seriously, his house had two addresses, yeah. We couldn't find it.
You mean like two front doors?
No. Like two. It was so big. It was an estate. It was so big. It was like, the A57 over here and the A46 over there. And in between it was Ian Anderson's, yeah.
Is this around the corner from where you live?
Yeah.
As we all know, John lives on Rockstar Millionaires Row.
Roger Taylor, his
studio. Who lives around the corner from
you? Exactly. I went to his studio. Because it's at his house, yeah.
Oh.
So, again, goes to my theory that we,
Okay. So, would you like to share with us in the studio with a rock band?
Well, what do you want to know? I mean, I've done them all.
Or just
do.
Pick one. You, pick one that we've heard of.
I've got to tell my one about. I've got to tell my one about. Who was it you were saying? Marillion. That's who you were saying. Marillion in Misplaced Childhood. That's good. Go on.
Stephen just told us if we keep going on about Marillion, he's going to walk out.
Yeah, he said, don't mention Marillion again. So let's start.
The trouble is, readers, is I've been in the studio with so many bands. You know, they beg me to come.
Because they know you're going to write some grovelly...
They play me the track. I stand there bored and say, that bass, turn it up a bit.
Well, no, you don't, because it's a horrifying position to be invited to the studio.
Actually,
you know
it really is.
They know that you know they're going to play their new album, whatever it is.
Oh, it's horrible.
And you have to say, and it's going to be at a volume where you can't even hear what's going on.
And the thing is, you have to sit there. You have to sit there pretending to be really into it.
Yeah, and what are you supposed to say after? Oh, it's great. Yeah, well, it's much better than the last one.
Well, you sit there going like this. Like,
Yeah.
I was in the studio with Metallica when they were doing Master of Puppets, and they said, "Here's the title track. Yeah. There's no vocals yet." Yeah. And I went, "Great.
How good that was!" Yeah.
So off it goes.
Yeah,
like, dun, 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 dun,
yeah.
Dun, dun,
Lars at the back.
10 minutes later, you know, and I'm looking, thinking, "Are they all still listening?" They're all like, "Cliff's going like this."
What do you think?
Oh, I better. Throw a bit of that in, you know.
It's a terrible experience.
Yeah, the worst one was when I was doing Black Sabbath's PR in 1980. I'd only just got the gig and they were finishing off the Heaven and Hell album in Paris with Martin Birch. Mm. And I took some journalists with me. They were going to do an interview, you know, for the album when it came out. And we were doing photographs at the Sacré-Cœur, very Sabbath, you know. And the only thing was Bill Ward, the drummer, would not make himself available. He was like, Bill's not well. He's very fucking ill. So, all right, don't worry. We've got Ronnie Dio, you know. Anyway, Bill didn't show up the whole weekend. He turned up for the photo session and all he said to me the whole time is, why are we doing this? Who are you? And I'm like, hi, Bill. I'm Mick. I'm from the PR agency. We're going to do some photos here. And so we're going to be, what? Who are you? I said, what am I fucking doing here? So this went on, and I just thought, well, he's mental. You know, I just fucking ignore him. The last night, we're getting a 6 a.m. plane in the morning. 2 a.m., I get a phone call from the tour manager saying, Bill wants you to come to his room. I'm like, tour manager was Paul. I said, Paul, I'm in bed. I'm getting up in a few hours to go to the airport. He went, Bill wants you to come to his room. So off I go. I get out of bed. I go to Bill's room. And he's in this huge suite at the Georges V Hotel in Paris. And as I arrive at 2:30 in the morning, the hotel plumber is leaving. And Paul's like, yeah, don't worry. Don't worry about him. Don't worry. Just ignore it. I said, what's the plumber doing here? He went, Bill's been throwing up for several hours and he's clogged up every bath, every toilet and every sink. So I've had to call the hotel plumber. And I was like, should we leave here? We'll leave here. He said, no, he wants to see you. So I go into this suite and he's got a balcony all flung open and you can see the Eiffel Tower, you know. And Bill is standing there completely naked apart from a dressing gown, which is flapping open. I mean, not even like getting a little peek. It's like, you know. And I said, well, Bill, you know, good to talk. What are we doing here? He said, I'm going to play you the album.
The dreaded.
Fuck! Yeah. And he goes, but we haven't done the vocals yet. And I thought, it's a joke. It wasn't a joke. So I listened to the whole of the Heaven and Hell album.
Yeah, it's great work. Great
without
album.
Vocals for about an hour while he sat there like that with his old todger hanging out and I'm having to go,
yeah,
that was great. What's this next one called?
Oh, I don't fucking know.
An hour. It was the longest hour of my life. I couldn't remember anything about the music. So that was a lovely
it's a
experience.
Lovely story, thank you.
Now, share one of your lovely stories from the studio.
Well, actually, no, talking of that, I am going to say Marillion again. This is...
Oh,
I don't mean to.
Oh, God.
But when the great split happened between Fish and Steve Hogarth, which was about 1987 or something like that, was it?
Yeah.
About then. They divided, obviously, into two camps, but they were both still on EMI, both still on the same label, which was obviously, you know, recipe for disaster. But... Brian Munt, who was Marillion's press officer and also Fish's press officer, really lovely diamond geezer, goes, Marillion have hired a studio. It's called the Mushroom Farm. You should come down and meet Steve and write a great story and, you know. All that. So me and Ray Palmer, obviously, drive down. And it was somewhere
the
off...
The photographer.
Yeah. It was somewhere off the M25, Sussex, something like that. We're driving down with it. Find this place. Is it... As they used to say, a big house with comfy sofas, which is what they used to really like. And Steve Hogarth comes sort of bounce. He was all, because he just like joined the band, you know, he's going to be famous. Comes bouncing out. And he's wearing this sort of fisherman's sweater. You know, like those long knitted white Aran.
Yeah.
Sweater, like the least rock and roll thing you could wear.
But that's his singing, because he's little and skinny. Yeah, likes a big baggy like jumper, floppy hair. Yeah,
that's exactly what he was like. So we, you know,
I play keyboards.
Yeah, we do all this. And they said...
Better than Mark.
They said, yeah, well, we've got, you know, we thought, we've got some stuff to play you. But we thought, rather than playing it back to you, we'll actually play it.
And you went, so, wow.
No, I did. I went, wow. So we sat in the what's it called? The sound room or whatever it's called?
The studio?
Yeah, but there's a room, isn't there?
Oh, like the rehearsal room?
No.
The live room.
There's a bit where there's a massive desk.
And that's called the studio.
Yeah, and there's a bit where the musicians
where they play.
Go, where they play.
That's called the studio, yeah. No. Tell us the story.
No, that's it. So it was the time of Season's End, and they said they put a chair there, literally put a chair in the middle of the five of them, and I had to sit in it. And they physically played three songs from the album.
And what did you do while you were sitting?
I don't
dance?
Know.
What did you do?
This.
Show us.
No, I was just like this. But you do realise, actually, you know, we take the piss a lot, which is fine. But how good they actually are, you know, and how good musicians are. And it was like there's great waves of sound, but I couldn't hear anything. But it was great, so I went away and did exactly what they wanted. Ooh, that seemed really no great. So, yeah.
Were you and Steve best friends forever?
Yeah, we've been best friends ever.
Best mates ever.
We've been best friends forever since that day.
Well, you're very similar, aren't you? The very first time I ever was invited to a studio happened to be the very first story I ever wrote for Sounds magazine that wasn't a little review of a punk band. And I was 19, still living at home with my parents, and Sounds called and said, Ian Hunter, the Mott the Hoople singer... He's in the studio producing this band called Mr. Big. Not the Mr. Big in the 80s, the original Mr. Big that had a hit with Romeo and Juliet. No one remembers that?
It was called Romeo. Yeah, just called Romeo. I remember that.
Yeah, well done.
You've passed the...
This is 1977, and they're like, look, he's producing Mr. Big. Get a bit of stuff about that, but just interview Ian, you know, get the goods. So they sent a limo. So I'm at my mum's house in this cul-de-sac, and a limo turns up, and all the neighbours came out to watch. And as I get in, they're waving. And it's like, no. In the limo was the EMI press lady, and the editor of Record Mirror, who was this very formidable woman that had been around for years, you know. And so I'm like this uncool prick that's just coming out of the... So we get in the limo and off we go to this residential studio in Oxfordshire. And they've got all... This is the 70s. They've got brandy. They've got all kinds of champagne. It's all going on in the back of the limo. Needless to say, by the time we got there, I'm pissed. And as we pull up into the, it's a farm type deal. We pull onto the courtyard. As we stumble out of the limo, here comes Ian Hunter, just happens to be walking across the courtyard. Now, I'd been a huge Mott the Hoople fan. I mean, literally 2 years before this, I probably had pictures of him on the wall. So I'm a bit nervous. Wow. Plus, I've never interviewed anybody before.
And this is literally your first interview.
First interview. Right. And Of course, he knows the record company lady. I can't remember her name, but oh, yeah, oh, great times. Yeah, oh, do are you at the party? Oh, yeah, you know. And then Roz, the editor of Record Mirror, who'd been around for years, she used to be on Disc and Echo and all this. He's like, Roz, she's like, Ian, oh, do you remember Paris? Oh, LA, you know. Oh. And then he went, oh, and this is Mick. And he looked at me and he gave me, literally gave me an up and down. And he went, how old are you? And I went, 19. And he went, yeah, I got a son about your age. And he turned his back on me and walked off. And I thought, oh, that's not good.
So here's a test.
Here's a test.
Test my.
So now we're in the studio while he's working with Mr. Big and they're recording some song. And as Stephen knows better than anybody, they just keep doing take after take and fiddling with knobs and whatever people do in studios. And it goes on for hours. And the idea is, no, just chill, just hang back. And when Ian's ready, he'll talk. It's like, fuck me. So about 3 hours go by. I'm still drinking. I'm now sloppy drunk and hardly think straight. And they're like, Ian's ready. Oh, fuck. You know, so we go in this room. Ian's ready, but he's very busy. So he'll have to interview him both at the same time. Roz is like, yeah, no problem. Consummate pro. I'm like, what? What? So we go in. I'm unpacking my old cassette recorder. And he goes, no tape recorders. I went, what? He goes, no tape recorders. I said, what am I going to do? He goes, oh, you don't do shorthand? You're not a real journalist. Roz is like, no problem. Out comes her pad. Psh, shorthand. So I'm given some paper and a pen. And I'm not asking anything because Roz is on the case. And I'm just sort of, the new album is my best in years. You know, that sort of thing. Yeah. And finally, I can stand it no longer. I'm this huge Mott the Hoople fan, but I'm an even bigger David Bowie fan. And finally, I just go, and they're like, so Mick, don't you have any questions? And I'm like, what's Bowie like? And it was like, oh. And it was like, come on, get rid of him. Yeah, you know when you're being got rid of. Mick, come and look at the garden. You know, why don't you sit in the limo?
Write your notes up.
And they didn't even run the story in the end. So that was a fantastic introduction.
That was lovely, yeah.
Yeah, to rock artists and studios.
Yeah.
And that's what made me the man I am
but
today.
But you're right, that thing of them, you know, constantly doing takes and thinking you'll be interested in that. Yeah.
Without the vocals.
Yeah. Well, without, or the, yeah, whatever it is they're doing. I mean, you used to have to, I mean, probably Stephen will disabuse us of this notion. But you used to have to do it one instrument at a time, didn't you? I believe that was the system.
Stephen will tell us. I'm sure he's way past that, yeah.
Start off with the drums. We always thought, like, how do you play? Yeah.
Another time in the studio. Have you got... What about you, John? One more for me.
I'd say what I was going to... You know, we were talking recently about Tony Clarkin, who sadly passed away.
Tony the Hat.
To the Hat, yeah. He was a really lovely fellow, but... Yeah. You know, fair to say, a kind of slightly parochial Brummy. You know, he wasn't a rock. He wasn't like Ian Hunter or someone.
No.
He was a, you know.
Wore a hat.
Yeah. And he was just, if you ever interviewed him, you're like, oh, Tony, you know, get my pad out, you know. What about, how did you come up with that song? I don't know, really. Yeah.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And he was very much like that. And you keep looking over. Are you? Is it time you were looking over?
No. Oh, keep going, mate. You're all right. I've got a shepherd's crook for when you.
So I was, and they got Magnum sort of had a little period where they were kind of getting slightly bigger than just playing the Hammersmith Odeon and selling, you know, 20,000 records. They got a bit bigger than that. And the record company decided, well, they'll send them to LA to record. And they'll send them with Keith Olsen, producer Keith Olsen, who had done, God, you know, Pat Benatar and White. He did White. He'd just done Whitesnake. That's right. He'd done Whitesnake remixes for America. He was the big guy. He had his own studio. So, they're like, you know, they said to me, oh, do you want to go? You know, we're with Keith Olsen at his studio, which is called Goodnight LA, out in LA. I said, yeah, great, you know. But his studio was in Van Nuys, which is, I was trying to think about how to.
If you've seen, that's the word he's looking for.
If you've seen the film Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, the Quentin Tarantino film, where, you know, the Brad Pitt character, who's the stuntman, and he drives the Leonardo DiCaprio character around, and he drops him off, and then he has to go home. And he goes home to some shithole, and he lives in a caravan with a dog. And there's a big sign that says Van Nuys. That's where it was. That's
so you were right at home.
Yes, I was right. Yeah. So we got taken out to Van Nuys and walked into the studio, and there's all these, and the studio was a bit like a. It wasn't. I thought this is going to be like a proper big, you know, Whitesnake have been here and all that. But Keith Olsen hadn't done that. He just remixed their stuff. He hadn't actually recorded with them. So Whitesnake had never been to this place or anything. We had this big row of gold and silver discs along the wall, and he'd left a gap in the, and he'd got a, like a post-it note or something, and he stuck it up there, and he'd put reserved for Magnum. Yeah. I thought, oh yeah, this is just gonna
class.
So we listened to the album, and they've made Tony Clarkin. The one thing anyone knew about Tony Clarkin was that he was a great songwriter. He could do all his own song. He did all the lyrics. He did all the music. He was like a one-stop Magnum shop. They decided because they were going to be famous, they should get him to write with other people. So they got him Russ Ballard, my chum. He'd written a song with Russ Ballard. Jim Vallance, who was the guy who writes with Brian Adams.
Right, Brian Adams.
Yeah, so he'd written all the, but they were no good, you know, because it wasn't Magnum.
Right.
You know, and so, yeah, it was one of those ones where you just had to sit there listening to the album.
The bad song. Yeah. Did you say, Tony, they're not very good, are they?
Well, yeah.
You didn't, did you?
I didn't. No, I came
You
home
sat and there and you went, they're great. Yeah. It's the best thing you've ever done.
Best thing you've ever done. Yeah, really good. Yeah, because it was, but yeah. So, and then, yeah, they spent all this money, spent like, you know, $500,000 or whatever. The album never came out. Never came out in America.
But you're right, though, John. Things have changed a lot. I mean, I was thinking, for instance, I was around a lot when Phil Lynott was making his solo album, Solo in Soho. And compared to now, where, you know, you wouldn't have a whole crowd of people in there getting under your feet and getting in the way. I remember he did record that at a studio in Soho. And was it the one at the Marquee, maybe? I can't remember. But in those days, there was much more of a sort of an entourage, and you would turn up. And I remember, because I knew Thin Lizzy and I was doing PR for other acts related. And so one night we just went down there, and it was packed. It was like a party. There were loads of people all doing drugs, all boozing, all smoking. And in the middle of it, Kit Wolven or someone like that trying to produce the record. But the thing I do remember the most is this studio had a, here's the desk, here's your producer, here's Phil next to him. And then behind is this sort of huge chorus of lunatics, including me.
Yeah.
And all the Thin Lizzy characters like Big Charlie and fucking Crazy Dave, Dangerous Frank, and don't talk to him, he'll kill you, you know, all these people. But it was, so there was like a bench you could sit on. And then behind that was another bench that went up. And then behind that, another bench that went up. And on the top bench was Paula Yates.
Mm.
And yes. Mm. And she sat there on the top bench with various friends. But it was very bizarre because she sat there on the top bench with her legs wide open in a tiny skirt and no knickers. Not that I noticed. I was told this afterwards.
Immediately averted your eyes.
I made my excuses.
You said, madam, you're wearing no knickers.
Please, madam, control yourself.
This is a recording studio.
People here are trying to create art.
Yeah, exactly. And you're here showing your...
Legs, yeah. Your attributes.
Yeah.
Yes,
I was urging Phil on. Phil was in there doing.
And of course, all the blokes
do you want
kind of
the Irish in your.
They're all nudging each other. You sort of go.
I can't.
No. And finally, Phil turns around. He looks. And he goes, ah, come on now, Paula, put it away, put it away. And she's like, oh, fuck off, Phil. And then just did it even more. So, I don't remember much about the music.
But hang on, this is Phil Lynott. She can't have been very old at that. I mean, I'm not going to go all...
No, she wasn't very old, John. No. I don't know where you're going with this, but early
20s. Oh, OK, good. Yeah.
What do you think? She was 12 years old or something?
I don't know. It's like Phil Lynott. I mean, I think of Phil Lynott, I think of the 70s, you know.
This was like 1980.
Oh, okay.
A year or two later, she was doing The Tube and all that stuff. Yeah. She had a column in Record Mirror, and that's how she kind of became famous in the biz. So that was an interesting studio experience. I wonder if Stephen, when he was making his...
Doesn't wear underwear.
If he's...
He's famous. He famously doesn't... No, it's shoes, isn't it? Yeah. Something like that.
We'll come to that, John.
I'm joshing, but I'm sure, you know, that would have been Phil's vibe, you know, Phil.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there was no no seediness at all.
No.
None.
No.
None whatsoever. None whatsoever. So, John, more
you know,
studio
did,
story.
You know did that to me, Jane Andrews. Do you remember Jane Andrews?
she wore no knickers.
We should
explain. Jane Andrews was an executive at Atlantic Records. She was blonde. I remember she was
the sort of the right-hand woman of Bill Kirbishley.
She became the right-hand woman for Bill Kirbishley.
She was
probably
by the
still
point,
is.
By the time this was happening, she was, because she was in charge of Judas Priest.
But long before that, John, she worked for Atlantic. And like when Rat were one of the bands, they came over... And I remember her asking one of the female journalists from Sound, you know, which one do you want to sleep with? You know, and she was one of those girls.
Right.
She did a tour with Robert Plant, and at the end of it, she suddenly had these really big bosoms. And she's like, "Here, Mick, what do you think of this?" And I went, I didn't see it first time.
Just like Paula Yates. No, I don't know what you're talking about.
I said, "Very nice." She said, "Robert bought me those." I said, "What do you mean?" She said, "Well, I was offered a tour bonus or new boobs, and I chose new boobs." And I went, "Let's have another look." So I don't know how we got onto that. You mentioned Jane Andrews. What did she do to you?
She was managing Judas Priest at this time, Priest had done an album called Painkiller, which was exactly as it sounded. And they did a Beano to Spain to listen to it. Again, go and listen to it. But it wasn't a studio. It was a hotel in Puerto Banús, which is like the kind of upmarket bit of Marbella. It's a beautiful Spanish hotel with about half a plane full of rock hacks. Got to Gatwick about like 5 in the morning. Got on a plane to Spain. Drive down to Puerto Banús. You can imagine what the bus was like. Paul Elliott was there.
Small debut. Sherry.
Chris Welsh was there.
Oh, who bloody hell.
By that time was probably in his late 70s. He didn't want to get up at 5 in the morning, go and listen to a Judas Priest album. Had a few drinks on the plane. So we go to and it's a beautiful hotel, really lovely. And it had a church in the grounds. It was a bit like the Sunset Marquee, but it had a church in the grounds. All these people were going into say mass and all this sort of thing. We all get given, the priest are there waiting to be interviewed. We all get given a Walkman with the album on it, and we're sitting by the pool.
Going
and
like
we
this.
Have to put it on and listen to it. And Welchie, by this time, is completely gone. And we put this album on. It's like, "He is the pain killer. I mean, it's like that sort of volume. And
actually, John, it's good to hear you sing. Yeah. I don't mean to sidetrack you here, but we've had a lot of readers commenting on your singing voice. Can you do that? Just do it one more time. How did it go?
It was like he...
Louder?
Like those Halford type lyrics. He's going to paramatalise you and all this stuff.
Do it again.
I see Welch's like this. He's going... By the pool, the sun's beating down, you know. And so you could hear it coming out of his headphones. And he falls asleep listening to the album. Jane Andrews comes out. She's like horrified by this sight of all these people. And yeah, she like was bending down trying to wake Chris Welch up. A little skirt like that. She's bending right down like this. And yeah, exactly
did
the
he
same
wake
as
up?
Paul. Yeah. No, but the rest of us.
The rest of you did.
The rest of us were like suddenly interested. And he's like, oh, do you want to go and talk to Robin? All right, fair enough. Yeah.
We should explain. Chris Welch was a doyen of music journalism on Melody Maker in the 60s and 70s, in the days when they were in Fleet Street. Lovely, lovely man. But he ended up at this moment in his career where he needed a job. He ended up on Kerrang.
Yeah.
And it was like the most inappropriate job you could give him because he was a much older man.
He had brilliant stories. He'd been on the plane with Led Zeppelin and all this. You know, the first job he got at Kerrang, Jeff sent him to interview Wasp on a video shoot. And he asked one of the best questions I've ever heard. Blackie Lawless is standing there. He's got that fucking cob piece on, you know, that he used to have. And it's got, I fuck like a beast written around the outside of the cob piece. And Chris Welch sort of looking at him. He goes to him, tell me, Blackie, how do you sit down in that? That was brilliant. And Blackie Lawless goes, you know what? Because I've actually got a chair that's got a slit cut in it so I can sit down like that when I'm coming off stage. So he actually got a brilliant answer out of Blackie. So he was that kind of guy. But yeah, Jane Andrews is actually, then we now know, provided by Robert Plant, waving these in his face to see if he'll wake up. And then she'd wandered off and he sort of woke up and he went, don't tell Jane, will you? Don't tell Jane.
Bless him.
No, he's a lovely man.
He was a lovely man, yeah.
I think he's still alive, isn't he?
Yeah, yeah.
Was then.
Well, he'd maybe not be anymore. He might be a bastard now, mightn't he? Says John. Right. Now, John, we're coming towards the end of our exciting...
I keep looking over there. It's very off-putting.
Well, why don't you look at the audience?
I do, but I can't
there's
see
an audience,
anything,
John.
Every time I look over there, it's just a light.
Any more studio stories?
No, I'm not telling anything else now.
He hasn't got any. No. I got a couple.
I got a couple about Marillion.
Oh, fucking hell.
Marino.
I'll tell you a Marillion story then in the studio.
Yeah.
I was with them in...
Finish us off with a Marillion.
Yeah.
You know you want to.
Yeah. I'm in the studio in Hansa Studios in Berlin with Marillion while they're making Misplaced Childhood. And
great album.
They had these
one
two
of the great albums.
But the A&R man from EMI was there, Hugh Stanley Clark. Do you remember him at all? Married to Jenny Stanley Clark. Talk about the odd couple. But anyway, Hugh's there and he takes it very seriously. This is 85. He's talking to me about
Childhood needs to be taken seriously, Mick.
But this guy took himself very seriously, John. He's talking to me about demographics and how we choose singles and all this sort of business. And so he makes them.
You were really you really had something to say about that, didn't you?
Exactly. He made the Chris Kimsey, the producer, play two tracks, and they were going to choose one of them as the single. And the first track they played was Kaylee. And I remember saying, yeah, it's all right.
Your instinct for the.
Oh, pounced on it. So, And then they played another track called Lady Nina, which eventually became the B-side.
It was a B-side. It was a good
song,
though.
And I'm like, now that's a hit.
Yeah.
Listen to me while I testify. That's a hit. You'll be bloody fools if you don't put that out. So they didn't put that out.
They didn't even put it on the album.
No, they put it on the B-side of Kaylee. And Kaylee, of course, was their biggest hit. It was one of the biggest hits of the year. But there is a story, because the song Lady Nina was named after a notorious... what would you call it, John?
It was an establishment very near or under the studio, wasn't it? It certainly became their gathering point after the studio.
And why it was particularly interesting for them was in terms of their history was because it was where Fish met his future wife, Tammy, Tamara, who was German. And she was
She ran the bar, I think.
She was the hostess with the mostess. Can we say that? I just did, I suppose. It was full of hookers, high-class hookers, drug dealers. So, of course, the band loved it. Mm. And they'd be there every night. And so they wrote a song about it, and Fish ended up marrying Tammy.
And she's in the video for Kaylee, if you want to know what she...
And she's in the video. Like, yeah. They did a video for Lady Nina, because they later released it as a single in America. But my main memory is, again, Ray Palmer, his name comes up. He's sadly passed on. But he was an absolute wild man photographer, wasn't he? And he was all about the sex, you know, wasn't he? If he went on a trip and...
We all, let's be honest.
Well, not like Ray. Yeah, he was a photographer. He called everybody darling. And women loved him, didn't he? And his whole chat-up line would be, I'd love to photograph you in my studio. Will you come to my studio? Will you come to my studio and take all your clothes off? And I'll photograph you. And they all went, yes. So he was quite determined in that area. And we're with Fish doing the endless interview, which accompanied by the endless cocaine and Jack Daniels and all the rest of it. And it gets to like 5 in the morning, that time when it's really like,
that time of
really got to go, you know. And Ray is disappointed because he thought Fish was going to take us to Lady Nina's. And he's like, so we're not going to Lady Nina's. And Fish is like, oh, come on, man, it's 5 in the morning. Ray's like, well, I'm still up for it. I'm not tired. I'm not sleepy. We could, Mick, you'll come with me, won't you? I went, no, not in a million years. I'm going to bed. Fish pulls out his credit card, his gold Amex or whatever it was, and goes, there you go, Ray. Take that and go to Lady Nina's. And Ray's like,
oh, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Yes, I will. Yes, I will. And I went, I'm like, Ray, fucking stop. Control yourself. And so there wasn't a lot of talk about concepts or albums, but there was a lot of talk about Lady Nina's.
Well, I mean, in fairness, that's what the album was sort of about, wasn't it? It was all about. But no, actually, it was more the neck clutching at straws that was the drug album.
Problems, problems.
Yeah.
Right. That I think is going to conclude our first half, yes. But after 15 minutes or so, come back in and we'll be welcoming to the stage someone who actually does know more than any of us combined about studios and a hell of a lot more. The one and only Stephen Wilson. So join us back here in about 15. Thank you.
Thank you.
You may clap.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
How do I stop this, Fern?